WUFTFM. This is Animal Airwaves Live. I'm Dana Hill. It's our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. So glad you could tune in here for this October 9th episode of Animal Airwaves Live, when my guest from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Carlos Souza. We're going to be talking today about something that may have affected you who are lovers of cats, that is a diagnosis of cancer in your pet and how it might be treated. Cancer is one of those devastating things, sadly, when it affects our pets, as it is with human beings as well. And we're going to find out more about cancer in cats and what we can do about it if we should receive that unfortunate diagnosis for our pets. So welcome to the program, Dr. Souza. Glad to have you along.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
When we talk about cancer, I'd like to point out before in the past on this program, you know, it's not some like monolithic thing. There are so many different kinds of cancers, and though they might operate sort of fundamentally in a similar way in terms of what they're doing to cells, the effects on different parts of the bodies are quite different. Can we talk about just kind of cancer in general so that we can understand what it is that we're dealing with?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very interesting because I think it is today when most people, probably even me, hear the word cancer, the feeling is extremely negative. And it can feel like a death sentence. And independent of the location or the type of cancer, there are cancers that are in people and in dogs, they're curable. And in cats, they're curable. And there are cancers that are not. So the diagnosis is the most important thing. And when we give the diagnosis here at UF, when we talk to the clients, what is the implication of this diagnosis? In other words, well, we have this diagnosis. It's a cancer. It's a very bad cancer. It's malignant, but we can potentially cure. And if we can't cure, what can we do and what can we offer in relation to time, survival time? Sometimes it's short, sometimes it's long. And what can we do to make the animal, the quality of life of the animal, to either maintain if it is well or improve? So I think one of the issues that we all face is the stigma, and that cancer is a bad word, and we kind of have to be prepared to, but what type of cancer and what are the implications of this versus another type of cancer?
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And here's where I'll point out the one good piece of news here is that for our cats, in this instance, what we're talking about today, they don't feel the stigma themselves. They only feel the discomfort that might come. And it's incumbent upon us as the caretakers of these animals to make the right choices for them on their behalf. So if we can overcome the stigma, that's really what matters, because the cats just know how they feel.
You're absolutely right. That's fairly commonly with some big surgeries. As you might imagine, we do some big surgery that disfigure the patient. When it comes from, if you think about a dog or a cat, dogs go more to the park than a cat. A dog that is missing a limb, although to an owner may be dramatic, to the owner of that dog may be very dramatic, the dog ends up receiving more attention because a person will feel more curious about coming by, especially if the dog is happy. The dog doesn't care how he looks. The dog is happy all the time. And from the dog's point of view, and I joke with the owners about that, but it is true. From the dog's point of view, the dog feels, well, after this event happened, I get even more attention when I go to the park. So everybody seems to love me more. But we anthropomorphize the disease in a way that how would I feel if I had my ear removed in comparison to a dog or a cat? How would I feel if part of my jaw was removed? And to some owners, they have a hard time going over that barrier. And to some owners, that is an eternal no, I can't do that. So what we try to do to overcome that natural resistance of owners with amputations and other major surgeries is to have another owner that went through talking to them. It's amazing that you can go over with use the medical terms and experience in this and that. And the ability that another owner has to just say, I was like you, I didn't want that surgery, and my dog is as happy or happier than he was. The pain went away, and I'm glad I did it. So it is a big stigma because owners feel that it is the surgeries on themselves, and they can't deal with the disfiguring that dogs go through or cats go through, despite the fact that the animals per se have no they don't feel that in a negative way. The disease is over. I don't feel pain anymore. I feel good.
Right. This is excellent to keep in mind as we continue our conversation today about cancer. Now, you, of course, understand this as someone who deals with this on a daily basis, but these animals who are experiencing cancer do sometimes feel maybe even a great deal of discomfort. Let's talk a little bit about how it might come to pass that someone will suspect that his or her animal is experiencing something that may be cancer.
So it's very interesting because if this was one of us, we probably would talk. I have this headache for 3 weeks. It gets a little bit better, but it doesn't, I'm not sleeping well. Or I have this pain on my leg for months and it's getting worse. Now I can barely walk. So we make these comments and then somebody will probably say, oh, you should see a doctor, even if we don't want immediately. And animals, they show signs of pain in ways that we still don't completely understand. It's very interesting because animals can have from becoming more aggressive to becoming more affectionate, for example, to from changing their habits in relation to eating or where they sleep or where they do their pee and poop. And that's something that some owners are great about it. And they say, well, my little cat never had this issue, and I'm concerned because that happened. She's eating. She continues to do everything else, but it is such a unique event. So what I usually tell the owners, because as you might imagine, Dana, we talk about a lot about quality of life. In other words, well, your animal may have a cancer that is terminal that eventually will affect the quality of life, and at some point we may need to make decisions. And how can we perceive the difference in the quality of life? Because it doesn't happen overnight. It's going to little by little occur, and we may get used to the new normal. Well, usually the dog would run and bark at the mailman. Not anymore. He used to come in, and then months later, he might not even want to come when I get to the door. And cats are the same. Cats, some cats, my cat, loves attention. And he loves to be put in certain positions, you know, scruff his belly and behind his ear. He likes to eat at that time. So what would alert some owners, especially on an older cat, is changes in attitude. For example, my cat who loves food, changing that would be a sign for me to search for veterinary attention. And it could be just dental tartar or gingivitis, or it could be something else. Well, the cat never pees outside of the box, and now is starting to pee on the sofa. There's no reason. So instead of being upset with the cat, is to take to a veterinarian because there may be something else. And it could be a urinary tract infection, something very simple to treat. But as many other diseases, cancers don't reveal themselves necessarily unless they happen in the surface, on the skin and on the muscle, and the owner notices the bump. But other than that, you might need some kind of a hint from the animal, and this hint may be very non-direct in a way that is just a change in behavior on something the animal has done, something for 10 years and now is changing, or something, something very simple that you should search for attention because it might be a sign that the animal is in some type of discomfort.
Okay, those are really great points, Dr. Souza. Would you say that the expression of discomfort that the cat is exhibiting, it may be urinating outside of its box, it may be an unwillingness to eat where previously there had been enthusiasm, does that help guide you towards the type of cancer that you might suspect? It, with, of course, the caveat that, as you say, these problems may be totally unrelated to cancer. There may be much simpler, more benign explanations.
Yes, absolutely. For example, oral cancer is one that if it is in the close to the incisors, on the tip of the tongue, the owner will probably notice that is there. But if it is in the back of the mouth, it may be hard. But if this animal starts pawing on the face or making noises when it swallows or having a hard time, well, she always loved dry food, and now is really eating much less, you know, or because animals will very unlikely bark for pain or meow for pain. Pawing of the face is one of the examples. For example, I'm a veterinarian. I have been a veterinarian for years, and I have a cat. And my wife was telling me, well, the breath of the cat is very bad. And I didn't think about looking in the cat's mouth, which turned out his dental tartar is terrible. You know, his teeth are terrible and needs cleaning. And, you know, and the cat's eating, the cat's fine. I didn't do that exam. Let me take a look at the mouth to make sure when tartar shows up. And as a veterinarian, I miss the tartar of my cat that is pretty advanced, and we're cleaning next week. But imagine other things. So I would think, you know, be aware of these changes. And some people are great when they take a look at their dogs or cats, but pets are a little bit more finicky when it comes to contact, because they only allow you to be glued to them and opening their mouth and doing this and that for some time. You know, we call cat minutes, because they only give you that little bit of time, and then they run away or they bite or scratch. It makes it even harder. One of the things that I say, for example, in relation to memory tumor, memory cancer in dogs and cats. In dogs, because we spay, and in cats, because we spay them early, they don't happen very often. But in dogs, we tend to pat the dog's belly. So it will be easier for an owner to feel a little lump on the belly in comparison to a cat. The cats not always love to be patted on the belly. They like the head and behind the ears and the neck. So a owner might take a little longer to find, and there's the fur that hides the tumor. The cat is doing great, doing everything it can, doesn't seem to have any pain or discomfort. So it might take a little longer for the owner to feel the tumor on the mammary glands because he doesn't put his or her hand there. And even if he does, he might not have the sensitivity, again, because the cat is doing so well. My brain is not reacting to that little lump because it feels it's something normal, if you know what I mean. So the sensitivity of us people might be decreased because the animal may have a bad tumor, and mammary cancer is often like that. Cats with a mammary tumor that is about a fourth of an inch can be curable versus half of an inch, it's likely not curable. And half of an inch is not a big tumor, if you think about it. But it is so bad that as it has time to develop and to change and to become something else, it might lead from a curable event to a non-curable event. So those are the challenges that all, you know, owners and veterinarians face when it comes to dogs, and even more cats, because cats are less tolerable to a long exam. Cats it's just their personality.
Yeah, you're exactly right about that. And just before we lead into our first break, I think a point that we can take away from this part of the conversation is, you know, maybe don't hesitate to seek veterinary attention, even if it's just to confirm that everything is okay. Everything might be perfectly okay. Maybe it is just a matter of the cat needs a routine dental cleaning. But if you can catch something early, you can perhaps help save your pet's quality of life.
Absolutely. And when it comes to a bump, a little tumor, a bump that it might be cancer, it might be not cancer, but when you feel a bump, whether it's affecting the animal, affecting the cat, whether it's in the mouth, in the head, under the skin, on the tail, you should always go to your vet, even if it's been there for a while. And your vet would likely recommend, to stick a little needle to do an exam, a cytology. We look at the cells under the microscope. And having a small 3 millimeter, let's say, most people like a tenth of an inch, let's put it like that, a tumor may be curable versus twice the size may not. So I think seeing especially lumps and bumps, which animals can have as we do, especially as we get older, many of them may not be cancer. But it's important to find out because your vet might be able to separate, no, this is okay, we don't need to do this right now versus this we need to address right away, even if the animal looks healthy.
outstanding advice, Dr. Souza. We're going to take a little break right now. And when we come back, we're going to be talking more about cats with cancer. My guest is Dr. Carlos Souza from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Dana Hill. We'll be back right after this. From WUFTFM, this is Animal Airwaves Live. I'm Dana Hill, so glad you could tune in on this October 9th, 2020, when my guest is Dr. Carlos Souza from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. And we're talking today about cats with cancer. And when we left off, we've just sort of had a nice overview. And one of the things that we'd sort of emphasized is that if you kind of are able to notice anything that you feel like is amiss, you might be able to get the animal some veterinary attention early on, when some tumors, for instance, might be more treatable. And that would be really wonderful in terms of helping you have a better quality of life with your pet. And Dr. Souza, again, thank you so much for being here on the program today. I wonder if we can talk a little bit about some of the different kinds of cancers that cats are more commonly diagnosed with. And actually, even before we do that, let's kind of give an overview here of just how common cancer is in cats in general. Is it something that is a frequent source of visits to veterinarians?
Yes, absolutely. And that's a great question. And it's becoming more and more common that both dogs and cats and even the exotic species have cancer. And one of the reasons for, there are a few reasons. One of the reasons for that is that they're living to an older age. So in the past, animals would often die, or at least as a population, would often die of infectious diseases. The same with us. We would die with polio, and we would die with a variety of viral and bacterial diseases, and now we don't. So today, a lot of people, most people, would die of cancer, heart disease, and diabetes. They're the three leading causes of death in human beings, and to a significant degree, they are the leading cause of death in animals, too. So animals more often don't die of parvovirus, which was a virus common in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Now they die old. And because they reach old age, cancer is absolutely more common in older patients, whether people or animals. And we end up seeing way more of that because of this fact that they live longer. In addition, animals share our environment. And now, as you know, we are exposed to a variety of chemicals, from plastic, from pollution, from products in general, from food, industrialized food, and they contain sometimes chemicals that on a chronic basis, they can affect us. Cats, for example, like dogs, they can be exposed to owners' cigarette smoke. And if you think about animals, not only they inhale that by secondhand, but some of that smoke is deposited on an animal's skin, and they can lick themselves. And by licking that, they get another addition of carcinogens. It's very interesting because there are some cancers in dogs, for example, that have been associated with pesticide use in the lawn. So the person uses that to avoid, you know, weed growth and animals and insects and such. And the dog rolls on the grass and then licks himself. And dogs that have that contact are in greater chance to having bladder cancer, for example. And in cats, there was a study that was not powerful enough because of the number of cats, but it showed a trend that suggested that cats that belonged to owners that were smokers had a greater possibility of developing oral cancer, which is a huge deal in cats because we don't have an answer until today. So, and the thought would be that, well, the cats also can, you know, secondhand smoke, but also lick the fur, which is, when we see animals there that belong to smokers, they reek of cigarette smoke. And so there's probably a lot of toxins there. The animals are cleaning themselves, and the concentration of those carcinogens happen to be in the mouth, and because of that, they develop the cancer. So, and in that, you know, in that way, animals become very good models for human disease, especially human cancers, because they share so many of our, they share the experiences of life, including the food and carcinogens and environment and the house, that they can benefit people by giving answers faster, and they also can benefit themselves by becoming a candidate for a therapy that would be extremely expensive for a dog or a cat. And now, because it is a trial, it becomes available. So the idea when we do these trials is not really to, oh, let's, they're practicing in animals. No, they're giving the animals the opportunity to have the same treatment as a human would have. And they tend to be much better models than mice or rats, because mice or rats are genetically, you know, engineered. They don't have good immune systems often, or competent immune systems. So animals become a model that helps human, because it expedites the research, and they benefit because they have a very similar disease.
Oh, can I get you to expand on this a little bit more in terms of this trial that you're talking about? We were talking specifically about a kind of oral cancer, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah. And the most common, there are different oral cancers, and the most common oral cancer in cats is by far squamous cell carcinoma. And cats have basically two forms of this disease. One that happens on the tip of the nose, on the tip of the ears of white cats, of light-haired cats. And those are associated with sun exposure. So cats that live in a house and they sunbathe, they can have mutations, like it happens to us too. So with us, when we go to the sun and we burn, we have a greater chance to developing squamous cell carcinoma with time in the head and the face and the skin in general. And cats that are light-haired skin can have those. And at first, it just looks like a little ulcer. And then there's another form of squamous cell carcinoma that happens in the mouth that is not related to sun exposure. We don't know exactly why it happens. Again, it tends to happen in older cats, but probably chronic exposure of carcinogens in association with the species that might have, just being a cat, might predispose them to that specific cancer. The issue with that is that because of the location, it's not obvious to the owner. The cat may continue to eat normally. The tumor may be, and the cat has a very small mouth, the cancer may take a while until the owner detects the cancer. And when we talk about cancer, one thing that is important, as I talk to the clients all the time in relation to the cancer that the client or I see, is not the true disease. The true disease microscopically infiltrates the tissue. So it looks like the cancer is, let's say, a centimeter, a third or so of an inch, but microscopically the cells have gone beyond. So what I try to do as a surgeon is to cut on the surrounding tissue to a degree that once I remove all the tissue, skin, muscle, bone, or you know, mucosa or something, depending on where it is, the cancer is in the center. When the pathologists look at the extremes of my removal, my specimen that contains tumor plus normal tissue surrounding it, almost like an island surrounded by sea, and the sea is the normal tissue, they look at that limit of my resection or my surgery and say, I don't see cells in the periphery of your specimen. And if that's the case, we call that clean margins. That means the chances of you having removed that whole cancer are high. In comparison to, I go just around the tumor and cut it out, it looks to me like I got everything. My eyes think I got everything, but I don't have the sensitivity to see the microscopic disease. So, and that is a deal with the squamous cell carcinoma in the mouth. The squamous cell carcinoma in the mouth happens mainly in three locations. On the frenulum, on the ventral aspect of the tongue, as the tongue attached to the mouth, the animals have frenulum like we do, in the mandible and in the maxilla. When it happens in the tongue, imagine that the surgery, in order to achieve those margins that I mentioned, would almost necessarily have to have the tongue removed. And cats do not do well without their tongue. And most owners will feel devastated by removing their cat's tongue, because eating is a big deal. Eating is part of happiness that we have and animals have. Also, when it is in the mandible, sometimes we see an itty-bitty tumor, like a fifth or sixth of an inch, and it looks like it's in the mandible, but then when we take radiographs or we do CT, we realize that the tumor is much bigger. It invades the mandible, the bone, and it goes much beyond what we could remove. And then it goes from the fact that, well, how do cats do if you remove part of their mandible? And we tend to joke with the students that cats are not small dogs, that cats are a completely different species that behave completely different when we do this or that. And when it comes to mandible removal, for example, which dogs tolerate extremely well, most dogs, when I remove, imagine, so we have dogs and cats and us have two jaws. So there are two bones that join in the middle on our chin. And I can remove half of a jaw of a dog, and the absolute majority of dogs, nearly 100%, will eat on their own within 24 hours. Most often they will eat the same night. So dogs tolerate mandibulectomy, which is the surgery for removal of the mandible, extremely well. Cats, not as much. And in the single study that there is available, 12% of cats never regained the ability to eat on their own. So they never learned, they never figured it out how to eat with part of their mandibles being missing. And that is a big number to me, because if an owner comes and I'm about to recommend a mandibulectomy, the owner needs to be prepared that it's about 1 in 10, a 10% chance that their cat is not going to eat. But also there are other complications. Maybe the cat will not be able to groom himself or herself. And that in itself, the cat changed the fur. The owner, the cat looks a little disheveled. The owner feels that the quality of life changes. And cats probably feel that changes because they feel dirty. So a mandibulectomy in a cat is a completely different event. So when we do in a dog, that's it. We do the surgery, the dog is in ICU for one night or two, and then goes home eating and happy. A cat, when we are about to do the mandible, a mandibulectomy or the removal of the mandible, we will put a feeding tube a feeding tube that comes out of their neck, and the cats do well with that, that at least we guarantee that if it takes a couple of weeks for the cats to eat, we can feed the cat in a simple way at home with the owner. So that is a major difference. The issue with the squamous cell carcinoma is that imagine in a same tumor on the skin, I can get margins that are very big, a few centimeters around that tumor, cut muscle, is not going to affect the cat, not going to affect anything, and I can close it. In a cat with a little jaw or a little maxilla, my margins of normal tissue that are removed around are not going to be that big because of the natural limitations of the size of the animal. And then for that, achieving complete margins is harder. And the nature of this particular tumor, squamous cell carcinoma in the mouth, is that they tend to be very infiltrative and they tend to come back. So the issue with the cats with this particular cancer is that, as it is now, is that nobody has an answer. Most cats will still succumb, will still die of disease, and will likely die of the disease in less than a year. And it's interesting in a way, not good, but interesting in a way, that most of these tumors will not kill the cats like many cancers with metastatic disease, disease of tumor growing in the lungs or somewhere else. That most cats will die because of local disease, because we fail to control the local disease. And that's why we're starting this new clinical trial, which is a very interesting trial with a very new vaccine that we hope will have an impact. When we do surgery, the idea is that as the trial goes and moves forward, it will be to do surgery followed by the vaccine to prolong the results of the surgery.
So what specific kinds of pets would you be looking for as ideal candidates for this clinical trial?
So this will be a cat with the oral squamous cell carcinoma. It's a specific cancer, and the reason why this trial is because it will get some information about how will people behave receiving this vaccine. So as it is now, the animal would have to have a diagnosis of squamous cell carcinoma. If it doesn't, we will do a biopsy here at UF, and then once we get a diagnosis of squamous cell carcinoma, then we move on. And in such situations, either the vet will have done, the referring veterinarian will have done chest radiographs, or we will do it here. But once everything is set, we prepare a vaccine. And the vaccine takes a couple of weeks, about 10 days to 2 weeks to be prepared. And the vaccine is made out of that cat's tumor. So the cat's own tumor is used to make the vaccine. One of the main companies there are in the pursuit of a COVID vaccine is using a similar method, which is an RNA vaccine. RNA is a precursor, is a recipe for proteins, as basically is. So the DNA is the code, the RNA is the messenger that tells parts of the cell to make proteins that are necessary for survival of cells. And RNA has been shown to be very, first of all, you can multiply RNA very, very quickly in relation to a virus, at least, which is not the case of squamous cell carcinoma. But because RNA will carry, in a way, the message of the DNA, it might stimulate the immune system better than many other vaccines. So this vaccine might have, and we don't know yet, the answer is we have no idea how well it will work. We're hoping it works well, but it might stimulate the immune system in a way that that makes the body fight the tumor. And that's a big challenge, as you might imagine. There are not many vaccines in people, even with all the money and all the research, that that kill tumor cells. And one of the reasons is that the body has been trained to not recognize self. In other words, the body should not be going and attacking the cells of its own body. People with rheumatoid arthritis or lupus, those systems that recognize self failed, and that's why the people are having those diseases. So, but with the exception of those people or those animals, the body, the immune system is trained over and over not to recognize self. So now what we're trying to do is, well, don't recognize everybody, but recognize these little parts here. And that's what becomes hard, because if the tumor recognizes too much, it might attack normal parts of the body. I'm sorry, if the immune system recognizes too much, it might affect other parts of the body. And that is an interesting event that happens to people that respond really well to the melanoma vaccine. They may develop vitiligo, which is the body attacking normal melanocytes, which are cells that make pigment that gives us our color. And so people that have melanoma may be cured of the melanoma, but then end up with vitiligo, you know, with a depigmentation, which is not necessarily an outcome that a person would want, but the person now can say, I'm going to live because I developed immunity. So the difficulty of immunity is that too much can be a bad event, too little doesn't kill the tumor. And that's, this vaccine is hoping to overcome some and give information about some of this of these events. And an RNA is a new mechanism of vaccines, and is a very interesting mechanism to treat. And hopefully you'll be successful to a degree, at least in this particular cancer, oral squamous cell carcinoma in cats.
Well, it's completely fascinating, Dr. Souza. We're going to take another break, and when we come back, we've got lots more to talk about the treatment of cancer in our pets, specifically cats. Stay tuned to Animal Airwaves Live. From WUFTFM, this is Animal Airwaves Live. I'm Dana Hill. Glad to have you along on this Friday, October 9th, 2020, when my guest is Dr. Carlos Souza from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. And we're talking today about cats with cancer, diagnosis, and treatment. And when we left off, Dr. Souza, you were talking about a clinical trial, and it occurred to me that the advancement of the treatment of cancers is really phenomenal. When I would guess that, say, 50 years ago, probably cats with cancer, that was probably just the end, right? I mean, did they do much to treat cats with cancer a couple generations ago?
No, that is very interesting, because the field of oncology is even less than 50 years of veterinary oncology, and a lot has changed since then. And again, people are more willing to treat animals with cancer. And we have a whole service here that only deals with cancer. And in the 20 years ago, very few schools would have that, veterinary schools. And now there are people like me that all I do is cancer surgery. So it changed a lot in these days. But all is dependent on education, but also dependent on money and research. Money for research is always tight, not only for researching people, but for researching animals, as you might imagine, is always tight. So, you know, the group that started this research, this particular idea of research, is a group of Shands, and so they're MDs, and they reached out to us, and we made collaborations. So often what we do is collaborations with MDs, and that treats a similar cancer in humans, and by that we end up benefiting both areas. We end up benefiting humans and benefiting animals.
And that's really wonderful. I imagine that probably a majority of funding for cancer research, though, comes from the human side, right?
Absolutely, yes. The majority, the big money comes tends to come with people, and in this model that was created, my co-investigator, the principal investigator on a human trial, is Dr. Natalie Silver, who's at Shands. Her interest, she's a surgeon, and she's her interest in research is squamous cell carcinoma in people, which is also a very common disease, especially for smokers, tobacco chewers, and others. And her goal is to, and it's a pretty devastating disease. And when we talked about at the beginning, more than a year ago, before this trial was even, could even start, we discuss about what could be a model for these diseases. Are dogs a good model? And dogs turn out not to be a great model, because in dogs, the disease is more often controlled by big surgery. And in cats, it becomes a perfect model because the disease is terrible and extremely aggressive. And so it becomes a similar disease in comparison to people. We don't face the metastatic disease commonly in cats, but I know that if we start curing local disease in cats and they start living 2 or 3 years, we're going to see more metastatic disease. The reason why we don't is that we're still so terrible at controlling the disease in the mouth. So they end up dying for local disease and not for systemic disease.
And just for the sake of all of us listening, when you talk about metastatic, you're talking about cancer that has spread from one area to somewhere else?
Perfect. Thank you. Yeah, this is exactly it. So a tumor, there's the local disease, and that's the local behavior of a tumor can be infiltrative and aggressive. But that tumor may learn to move out of that mass, get into the lymphatic vessels or the blood vessels, which is a very inhospitable environment, and then move around and then survive somewhere else. And that is a very difficult task, because if you imagine, we don't grow cells outside of where they should grow. A cell of the skin is not going to grow in the liver or in the lung. And so tumors need to really go against the rules of the body, the laws of the body, and that is a task that some tumors can develop, and they develop that by achieving mutations and becoming and learning how to do things. And yes, metastasis is when the cancer starts to grow in an area different than the primary. And most common places, I mean, the most common places for metastasis are the lymph nodes, which drain the area, lungs, and the liver, but it can be anywhere in the body.
When we talk about the kind of advancements in the treatment of cancer in our pets, or even people as well, and as we were just discussing, it's come a long way in just a generation or two, are you able to kind of speculate as to what advancements you might see in the future or hope to see kind of within reason?
Drugs, first of all, there are drugs that are now developed for animals, and the molecules, they are developed by pharmaceutical companies. Because when pharmaceutical companies develop a molecule to treat one or two diseases, they often develop slightly different molecules. They are the same function, and one molecule might work better in people, and they might be well tolerated by a person, but But that second molecule that looks almost the same may not. But an animal may tolerate that. They already put the money for the early development, and they might do clinical trials to use that. The capability that we have to do imaging that has improved dramatically over the years. Our CT scan here is the same CT scan they have at Chan's, for example. So we have an extremely high-quality CT scan, which is amazing when we're planning surgery. And all the diagnostic tests, they trickle down. It takes a few years, but they trickle down to veterinary medicine. One of the new things there's going on is what's called liquid biopsy, is the ability to pull a little bit of blood from a patient and detect small amounts of molecules that show that this patient has the cancer coming back. And a woman with breast cancer or a man with prostate cancer, for example, there's already a test that has been approved for some of these patients that you get a little bit of blood now and then maybe over 6 months and then in a year. And then if the person's cancer comes back, then that little bit of blood may detect. And then, of course, the person is going to have to go through imaging and to find out where and a little bit more information. But the idea is to detect even the metastatic disease very early. When there's very little disease, it's easier to treat in comparison to when the person is sick because of metastatic disease. And this will take longer to reach us, but we already get molecules that there were once destined to people, much better quality imaging, much better quality equipment for surgery, and absolutely much better quality of not only equipment for the ICU, the post-operative period, but people to train people. Because when we do, for example, I use the ICU often when we do these major surgeries, it's a lot of trauma to the patient, and the first 24 hours they need an excellent support. And we have a team that is their specialty is to do that, to support animals that are critical. So we tend to do these big surgeries, and our survival is still very high because we have the whole team from diagnosis in radiology to us in surgery to anesthesia that is preparing the patient for surgery to the post-op. So it's a whole team that learns as we get better and makes the success of surgery, which in the past may have been terrible, much better, and the animal will go home and enjoy life as we want them to do.
Oh, we certainly hope so. Now, I wonder if it is much more likely that the kinds of surgery that you're describing, particularly something like a mandibulectomy, is that what you called it?
Mandibulectomy.
Yeah, that's much more likely to take place in a large clinical setting than, say, a local veterinarian's office, right?
Yes, most of the surgeries that we do surgery for small tumors, but most of the surgeries that we end up doing are for very big tumors in areas that are complex. And a mandibulectomy, which is the removal of parts of the mandible, or another one is called maxillectomy, which is a big name, but it's removal of the maxilla, parts of the maxilla, which is the upper jaw. Which it turns out cats do great. We're part of a study that a colleague just published that shows that cats do very well with removal of the upper jaw of the maxilla in comparison to the mandible. And that is something that we knew individually, but somebody, the author, decided to put all these cases together. We submitted some cases and to show that they tolerate. So now other vets can do, but absolutely many of these surgeries, the general practitioner is just not trained to perform and doesn't have the support. So that's why I'm here, for example, and the whole team is to do these bigger surgeries.
The treatment of cancer that I've heard a lot of talk about, treatment involving
immunotherapy.
Immunotherapy.
Immunotherapy is a very interesting thing. So the first guy that did this many, many years ago, I think it was in the 1800s, was an MD that decided to inject bacteria in a patient that had a big malignant cancer, a big sarcoma on his belly. In Scully. Scully is the name of the doctor, the last name of the doctor. So basically, he got bacteria, diluted that bacteria, injected with a syringe in the cancer, in the patient's cancer. Of course, the patient developed a huge infection, and that infection was so dramatic that nearly killed the patient, but it didn't. So the patient survived, and the tumor went away.
And the tumor went away because the body's immune system was so hyped up that now we decided that it could recognize that tumor as a foreign entity, and then it went there and killed it. And the tumor, our immune system probably kills cells on a daily basis. They are just mutated enough that the immune system goes there, recognizes and kills it, and gets rid of that cancer before it even can be seen or detected. The issue becomes that many of these tumors do not show themselves in a way the immune system recognizes. So in other words, in order for the immune system to recognize, the cell needs to have some flags. And those are usually molecules, little chemicals that stick in the outside of the cell that allow the immune system to recognize. So many ways that we can identify, say, well, does this particular tumor express something? When I say express, I mean show something in its cell that is different than anybody else. Only the cancer has that. In other words, another word to use is antigen. Does the tumor have a unique antigen that only the tumor has? And that is a little bit of the grail that everybody wants to find, and it doesn't, because usually tumors express some things that are unique, but some cells of the body also express that. And then it becomes a point of maybe the tumor expressed more of that specific molecule. And if I prepare a vaccine or a treatment that targets an antibody, for example, that targets there, the other areas of the body, because have less of those molecules, they become they're not going to be as sensitive than the tumor. So immunotherapy almost always, like any therapy, chemotherapy and surgery, always has a possibility of causing clinical signs. The hope that, as it is now, and maybe in 20 years it will change, but the hope that we had that tumors are so unique that a treatment will kill tumor cells and not kill any other cell of the body, it's extremely uncommon. There are some treatments in people and sometimes in patients that the tumor has a genetic mutation that if you use this particular drug, it only affects the tumor cells, but that's rare. So the immune therapy, it is not a panacea, is not going to cure everything, and probably it will work best after surgery or after radiation therapy, but it is a way to stimulate the immune system to kill tumor cells. The lesser the number of these cells, the better it is for the immune system. The better the recognition, the better it is. And the least amount of groups of cells, other than the tumor cells, that have the little flag that shows, hey, come and kill me here, the better it is, the safer for the patient. So it's a humongous task, as you might imagine. Millions of researchers in the world are looking for alternatives. You might have seen in commercials the PD-L1 pathway for lung. There's a new drug that is a monoclonal antibody that was approved for people with lung cancer that have this molecule expressed in their surface, and it seems to be very good. So this is one of the success stories of many others, their researchers that have tried and failed, unfortunately, but that's science.
Now, finally, Dr. Sousa, before I let you go, folks who may be interested in learning more about the clinical trial that you described earlier, they obviously need to have a cat that is experiencing the type of cancer that you described. Do they reach out to you, or would they connect you through their own veterinarian?
Either way, they can reach out to us, and we have a group of people that are dedicated to this clinical trial. There are other clinical trials. We have clinical trials for dogs with osteosarcoma, a bone tumor, clinical trials for dogs with oral melanoma. Oral is an oral cancer that is common in dogs, and often the veterinarians know about it, and they contact us and we schedule an appointment, and we discuss with the client. I was contacted by a client recently via email because she heard about the trial, and you know, this trial just opened this past month in September, so it is really new, and And either the client contacts the vet, and the vet sends the information, and we schedule an appointment. And one of the interesting things about the trial, which is not often the case, is that if the cat qualifies for the trial, the treatment is paid by the trial. The trial is funded, so the clients will not have to have the costs are covered, which is a big deal for some people, as you might imagine, especially these days. So this trial, once the cat is qualified, because some will not for a variety of reasons, but once the cat qualifies, the treatment is funded. So it will not be the client's responsibility to pay for the treatment.
Well, Dr. Souza, thank you so much for talking to me today. This was a really informative conversation. I learned a lot, and I appreciate you taking the time.
Dana, thank you for the opportunity. This was great.
I want to say thank you to Sarah Carey and her colleagues at the UF College of Veterinary Medicine for their help with this program. I'm Dana Hill. I hope you can join me next time for another episode of Animal Airwaves Live.